You're listening to Episode 8 of Season 8 of the GNU World Order. Hi everyone, this is Klaatu and this is the GNU World Order. We talk about Linux and Unix and GNU and all kinds of geeky topics. And if you're a long-time listener, then you know that this is a little bit unusual for GNU World Order. We're releasing about 2 days early, and the reason for that is because on this day that you are hearing it, not the day that I'm recording it, of course, I'm recording it in your past, but on the day that you're hearing it, a very big world event is supposedly going to occur. You probably can guess what it is. It's been in the media a lot lately. It's supposed to be worldwide, impactful, very significant, very important. I am speaking, of course, of the release of Enlightenment 17. Enlightenment is a desktop that I kind of go way back with. I think I've probably said this with a couple of different things, but I think this is true insofar as I remember. Enlightenment might have been the very first Unix desktop that I ever tried. It was on an older operating system that I no longer use, that I used to use. Deep Geek, you can drink a cup of coffee now. I started the thing up, installed this Enlightenment desktop thing, which I had no idea what it was yet, started it up, and it utterly failed, but it spat back an error explaining what I needed to do to fix the problem. And it told me that that's how I learned about like a .xinit RC file or a .xinit or something, xdefaults maybe it was, some file like that that I learned from this error that I needed to have. And so I did what it told me and put this in my home directory and started it again, and suddenly it worked. It was such a cool experience. I remember it quite well. So this was one of the first desktops that I used. It's probably right up there with Window Maker. I'm not sure which one was technically first. I know Fluxbox was the first one that I used on Linux, but on Unix, it was either Enlightenment or Window Maker, and I think it was Enlightenment. So anyway, point is, I go pretty far back with Enlightenment, and I've used it here and there, more 16 than 17, to be honest. And someone, well, thrice in IRC, had me try E17 again, I don't know, a year ago or so. And I tried it, I think at the time I was running BSD on a Toshiba laptop that I had, and probably Slackware on Triple EPC. I tried it again, and it didn't perform that well, and so I kind of swore to myself privately that I would not try E17 again until they themselves said that it was ready. I didn't want to keep going back to it and keep getting disappointed by having it work great for the first 10 minutes, and then once you actually put it through tasks and actually work on it for real for hours at a time, it starts to get all crashy and not as good. So I decided that I just wouldn't look at it again until they released their proper version, the one that they are declaring their release. So hopefully they do release today on the 21st when you're hearing this show. That would be really great. And the reason that would be so great is because, frankly, E17 is amazing. Yes, I cheated. I started trying it before they released. It's not my fault. Claudio M., who you probably know from Linux Basement, in IRC found slacke17.sourceforge.net, where some guy has built binary packages, Slack packages, for Enlightenment 17. Obviously not the final release yet, because, again, I'm in your past. But when I saw how easy it would be to install, right, they're Slackware binary packages. All you do is download them. They're not that big. They're like 111 megabytes for the big bundle. And you just do, and he even included an install script in there. So you just do install-enlightenment.sh max, as in maximum. And it installs everything plus a couple of dependencies that he decided to throw in there for kicks. And it's done. You know, it's there's no compiling necessary. It's all pre-compiled. So I tried it out on a test box that I had set up this past week anyway for testing of Sport, my slackbuild.org front end. So I tried it on there, x86-64, Slackware 14. I think it's an AMD Sempron with like 2 gigs of RAM and a really bad graphics card. It's just a computer that I rescued out of someone's office. They got an upgrade, and so I grabbed their old desktop and started using it for my test box and tried it on there, E17, and I was very impressed, and I kept using it all day, And I really couldn't find anything wrong with it, and that's a good thing, so I decided to try it on my triple EPC. Now, you know how old triple EPCs are at this point. I mean, I'm talking the original, not the 7-inch, but the original 9-inch screen triple EPC, 901 or 900, whatever. 900 megahertz Celeron CPU. I think it has 2 gigs of RAM, and it's still got that 16 and 8, I think, or 16 and 4 gigabyte SD cards in there. So, not a super power. And what's the graphics card? Like that gosh-awful Intel chip that people were shipping for the longest time? 945, 965 GSM or whatever it was called. So those were horrible chips. I knew it even then because I just saw too many glitches. I knew that was a bad chip. Intel Mobile series? Great. Intel Mobile 3000 HD? Love it. Really do. I think that's a great chip. 945, 965, whatever that series was? Horrible. Anyway, tried the Enlightenment 17 builds on that thing, and it's running like a champ. It's amazing. So what is so great about Enlightenment 17? Well, first of all, it is its own thing. If you've not used Enlightenment for any length of time, or if you used it and then have been away, like myself, there are some things to get used to. But once you get used to them, you start to really, really like them. I fell back into it pretty quickly because I had used E16, and there are a lot of things that are still kind of the same, but it took me like an hour to kind of remember how to get back into that mode. But one of those things, for instance, is the desktop switching convention. You drag a window to the right of your screen, and that'll push you over onto the next desktop, but in so doing, your mouse switches, because now you're pushing against the right side of your screen. So your mouse, once you go onto the next desktop, your mouse arrow now ends up on the left side of the screen. I don't think all desktop environments do that. I think if you push against the right side, then you switch desktops, but your mouse is kind of still where you left it. You know, it's still kind of up against the right-hand side of your screen. In Enlightenment, it snaps your mouse back over to the left side of your screen. I mean, it makes sense. Like, if you think about it, if you're pushing against the right side of a screen to get onto, like, this invisible extension of the screen, then if you're moving your viewport over to the right, then your mouse would be left on the left. So it makes sense, but it does take a little bit of getting used to. And the other thing that's kind of similar to that, and this is new, I've never noticed this before on anything, much less on Enlightenment 17, but when you open a new window, or you cause a new window to be opened, like a preferences window or a configuration kind of panel, Enlightenment moves your mouse cursor over that window for you. That sounds kind of annoying to hear about it. Like, I think if someone had told me about that, I would have just thought, that's horrible. Because there's a use case for not doing that. Like, if I'm on my workstation multitasking all over the place, I do. I've opened up a window in advance. I've opened up a Dolphin window or an RxVT window because I know I'm going to need one, but I'm not ready to go over to it yet. So I'll just hit my keyboard shortcut for whatever that is and then keep working wherever I am. So it's not necessarily always something I would want, but Enlightenment 17 does this thing where if you open a window, it moves your cursor over that window so that you can then just start working. It actually makes a lot of sense, it's very efficient, and it's not annoying. Now, I could be, maybe it's just that I'm not multitasking quite as much yet on the Enlightenment box that I have, compared to the Fluxbox machine and the KDE machine that I actually do, like, quote, real work on. That could be the case. I don't know. But I've noticed it, and it's impressed me. So far, it's never annoyed me. So that must mean something. Let's see, what else about Enlightenment? Well, I seem to think that this release of Enlightenment, this version of Enlightenment, hopefully it is a release, a proper release, we'll find out, or I'll find out, you already know. One thing that I've noticed is that it seems to be a little bit more configurable. I remember about a year ago when I tried it last, it felt, and it could be that I was just not being as ready to adapt. I might have been, maybe I wasn't ready to change the way that I work, but it felt like I couldn't do as much to configure my environment back then as I can now. And I still notice even now that it's not, in terms of like the way that I work, it's not a drop-in kind of replacement thing. I mean, for me, KDE and Fluxbox, the way that I configure those two, they're very, very similar. You know, I have certain things that I assign to certain keyboard shortcuts. I kind of have certain widgets and docklets that I, or if not docklets, then applications that I use frequently. And so it really is, I'm just kind of pulling out the rug from underneath my desktop and slipping in something new. And I don't really notice that much. And that's the way that I have them configured. I mean, there's a difference, obviously, but I still treat them both very, very similarly. With Enlightenment, I have not found a way to do that yet, and I'm not sure that I need to. At least that's not how I'm feeling right now. I think last year, or whenever I tried it, I'm just saying last year arbitrarily, but whenever I tried it last, I didn't want to. I wanted it to be a drop-in replacement. It's like, yes, give me a new look and feel, but don't make me feel any different. Now I'm using Enlightenment 17. I'm cognizant of the fact that it's a different environment, but I'm somehow willing to adapt. And I don't know why that is. It could be because I'm just in a different head space than I was before. Could be that GNOME 3 came in and said, hey, look how pretty I am. Now adapt to me. And I chose to. So now I've become more flexible because GNOME 3 kind of intervened and made me want to change a little bit. And now Enlightenment is here again. And now I'm okay with change. I don't know. It feels more adaptable. I've got a couple of important keyboard shortcuts that I've assigned. It's not at all like I use Fluxbox or KDE. It's much more centric around this run command interface that Enlightenment has called run everything, which is really slick, by the way. It's more than just a run command interface. It's like a run command, a search, a launcher creation place. It's cool. I haven't really explored it all I want to yet, but it's quite nice. Run everything is what it's called. So my workflow has changed, but so far that hasn't been a problem for me. The mouse, the focus following mouse thing, which of course you can do on anything. And in fact, on my laptop, I have that turned on. I don't really remember why I did it on my laptop, on my KDE Slackware laptop that I am recording this episode on right now. I do a lot of music on that laptop for some reason. And with QTractor, with all the different windows, I guess it's just nice to kind of have focus following mouse. I'm not really sure. I don't remember why I did that, but that's just something that happens on my laptop now. So I know that you can do that elsewhere, but it feels very Enlightenment to me. Like when that happens, especially in Enlightenment, I'm like, oh yeah, this is Enlightenment. I know this feel. They've got a cool new little terminal called Terminology that seems quite nice. Not sure if it's going to tear me away from RxVT. I've done a lot of cool things with my RxVT lately that I'm kind of really used to. But what I've been doing is kind of getting back into screen a lot more, like Terminology plus screen. Whereas I'd been using RxVT much as I had console as kind of a replacement for screen. And it's not a bad idea to get more familiar with screen because, of course, that's in no way GUI dependent. So that's kind of nice. And then the look and feel of Enlightenment is fantastic, too. I mean, I think the cliche about them is that they've been very, very filled with eye candy, perhaps a little bit over the top. And they push the envelope here. I mean, they've got a lot of glowing and throbbing and highlighting and pulsing going on. But it seems like they've scaled back a little bit, and they've kept it muted to such a degree that it doesn't, you know, it feels like they've kind of shown some restraint. It's not just for show. Now the really cool thing about that is that on my Triple E PC, it looks like $1 million. And I mean that from every possible angle. I mean, it looks good in terms of like the design, but it the animations and the zooms and the swipes and the slides, everything happens like it's supposed to happen. You know, it's not one of those like, oh, I'll get halfway and then I'll buffer in a millisecond and then I'll keep going. It's just, it's smooth. It's as if though the thing was like custom compiled on my Triple E PC. And mind you, this is like a binary that I downloaded. It's perfect. It's seamless. It's flawless. It's beautiful. It's fast. It's responsive. It's incredible. I mean, Fluxbox is like that on the Triple EPC, but you kind of feel like you know why it would be like that, because Fluxbox is just so darned minimal, right? I mean, yes, you can theme it and make it look really cool. You can put docklets everywhere. You can have a nice little wallpaper. You can do that. It's cool. It looks very neat. I like it. But you feel like you yourself have implemented the speed increase, right? Like yes, I'm running this lightweight window manager, and that is why my triple EPC still is a fast machine, or I should say a responsive machine. But for enlightenment, you don't feel like you've done anything. You feel like it's just magic. You don't even understand why it's responsive in the way that it is. It doesn't feel like it should be. You look at it and you're like, how is this possible? I mean, I kid you not, on this AMD Simpron computer tower that I tried enlightenment on initially, I was doing some theming on it, and I had the Cairo dock going. And that thing could barely, I mean, there were times where it couldn't even, with OpenGL and stuff, it couldn't even draw its own background, you know? It would just have, like, this black box behind the dock. It was really ugly and bad. And the transparency was not working. I put Enlightenment on the same computer. I'm not talking about, like, a reinstall and tweaking and a fresh, you know, it's the same computer. I installed Enlightenment. I logged out at KDE, logged back into Enlightenment. And the thing is, like, beautiful, you know, transparencies and flashing lights and pulsing icons and fades and sweeps and slides and everything you could imagine. As if though, I mean, it felt like the computer had just gotten a boost in, you know, in its graphics card. But it's the same graphics card. To say nothing, then, of the triple EPC, which, as I've said, old computer, really bad graphics card, the whole nine yards, looks fantastic. It's really, really cool. In other words, to sum up, I cannot recommend Enlightenment 17 enough right now. Granted, it's only been about 3 days, and it hasn't been straight 3 days of usage. It's been using it in the afternoons, using it early in the morning, you know, here and there. It hasn't been, like, literally 72 straight hours of using Enlightenment 17. But so far, I've not seen any of the indications that I saw earlier, like a year ago or whatever, when it was acting a little bit crashy or a little bit finicky here and there. I mean, it's been flawless. It's been flawless on two different machines. It's been a pleasure to work with. It's been beautiful. It's really exciting. I would definitely, you should try it. However your distribution allows you to try it, try it. If you have a Raspberry Pi, I'm going to try, and maybe you should too, I'm going to try Enlightenment on that thing, because I'm really curious to see how that performs, and I'll bet it's going to be really cool. I'm waiting on that until the Slack builds for the proper release come out, because I want to compile it onto the Raspberry Pi. So, bottom line, try Enlightenment 17. It's really, really nice. It's come a long way. Whether or not they actually release today when you're hearing this, it has progressed phenomenally, and it deserves a look. So if you're at all interested in a lightweight and attractive desktop, as its reputation goes, it lives up to it. Try it. You'll enjoy it. Okay, now on to listener feedback, which, if you're a regular listener, you would know that usually comes before the very first segment. It is usually the first segment. But this time I felt like everyone was waiting with such great anticipation for Enlightenment on the 21st. I figured I should just go ahead and get that out there straight away. So now we're doing listener feedback. So the first listener feedback email was from Siggy, or Sig, or Sigge. I don't really know how you say an E. It's actually a 3, but then he emailed me and said the 3 is, like, you know, an E. And he said that his friends call him Sig, S-I-G-G-E. But I don't know enough, well, any, really. Norwegian or Swedish or whatever it is, I think it's Norwegian, to know whether it's Siggy or Sigge or Sig, silent E. I like Siggy. I think it sounds, you know, cute, so Siggy. So anyway, Siggy wrote me back from having written earlier, saying, you know, commenting about the whole compiling from source code / dependency resolution issue, and I think we're kind of down to, we've been talking about this both on the show, and of course he and I have been emailing back and forth. So at this point, where you're coming in now, he's saying. Well, first of all, to clarify, he loves compiling from source as well, so everyone should not think that Siggy is going around saying no one should compile from source. I don't know if I misrepresented him or not. I obviously never want to misrepresent anyone. A lot of times I read emails on the show more from the perspective of what they made me think of rather than what the person actually was saying, which is probably bad practice, but that's kind of how I receive them. You know, you email me, and even if you're saying the weather was nice today, and that makes me think about, you know, the availability of weather information in pure text mode, and I go on I don't want to say rant, but, you know, if that triggers a conversation about that, then that's great. I think that's good. And that's maybe not necessarily at all what you even were thinking of, but that's what it made me think of, so that's kind of what I'm relating to the listeners. And that's that. So Siggy loves compiling from source, as do I, and I'm sure you do too, dear listener. And he's also saying that the one thing that I think completely went over my head was that he was literally asking, like, what's this debate about dependency resolution that you're talking about, Klaatu? Because apparently a couple of episodes ago, I mention it in passing as if though everyone's sort of in on it, like everyone's aware of it. And yeah, maybe that is a little bit weird. So here's the deal with that. In Slackware proper, and by Slackware proper I mean exclusive of ZenWalk and Salix and Slacks and any other derivative of Slackware. So in Slackware proper, there is no dependency resolution. And many, I dare say most, although I did not do a poll, many Slackware users do not have any desire to have an automatic dependency resolution system implemented by default in Slackware. And I say it that way because I mean it that way. There are some Slackware users who are perfectly fine with dependency resolution as long as they are sort of implementing it in their own way. And I guess to harken back to K5 Tux's feedback and a couple of other people who said, hey, Klaatu, you're building Q files, so you're doing dependency resolution. You're just doing it your own, you know, you're just doing it your way, and the user sitting next to you is doing it maybe in the same way. You're basically doubling up on effort, but you are doing that anyway. And, you know, we can talk about whether a Q file and sort of a batch process is the same as, hey, if I uninstall this package, it ripples through and uninstalls a bunch of other stuff that maybe I never intended for it to uninstall. Maybe I want to keep those things just because I'm uninstalling the thing that all those dependencies led up to. It doesn't mean when I remove that thing, I want everything to ripple back down through the system and remove those dependencies. It's kind of almost a meta kind of like package, you know, of stuff that yes, you get together, and if you remove one piece, then everything else will go away as well. So maybe that's not what I want. Maybe it is. It depends on where you're from. Point being, Slackware users don't seem to want that. They don't want automatic dependency resolution, at least not in such a way that it is implemented by someone else in a default manner. And frankly, I'm squarely right with them. I do not differ from that majority feeling that dependency resolution is unwanted in our distribution. I called Slackware our distribution. I kind of feel like part of the Slackware community now. So that's the debate that I was referring to. And there are, you know, every 6 months or every 8 months or every year and a half, I don't know, things move pretty slowly around Slackware. Every so often, someone chimes into the mailing list, one of the mailing lists, whether it's Slack Build users or Slackware or whatever, and they say things like, I want to implement dependency resolution, so let's all do this. And that usually sparks sort of a flame war. You know, it's kind of akin to going into a Debian forum, for instance, and saying, hey, let's switch to RPM or you know, whatever. You know, it's like it's one of those buttons that you can press to start a flame war. It's a really easy target. go into a Slackware place and say, why don't you have automatic dependency resolution? And people will respond. People get angry. And so that's kind of the debate that I'm talking about. And the reason that people don't want it is I think the stuff that I've already covered, really. I mean, I think I've now delineated what a lot of people see wrong with dependency resolution, whether it's because you don't know what is going on, because you didn't install that thing yourself, so you feel less informed, or whether it's because it annoys you that when you say, remove PKG FFmpeg to Theora, it then tries to, you know, in this dark imaginary world, it would then try to remove FFmpeg itself as well as FFmpeg to Theora, and maybe libxvid and a whole bunch of other stuff, and you're like, well, I didn't want to do that. I just wanted to get rid of this one package. Why is it trying to force me to get rid of all these other packages? And so then you have to go into some kind of configuration file and pin things or blacklist things, all this other stuff that Slackware users just don't seem to want to do. So that is the debate that I am referring to. And if you're in the Slackware proper community, then you're aware of that because it's something that people debate, you know, and it's something that people coming to Slackware sometimes will rush in, and as if though no one else had thought of it, they'll say things like, I got this great idea for dependency resolution, as if though that was something Slackware users were looking for, you know, like, I've got the answer to all your problems, and actually no one wants it. Or people come in and say, I know you've got this system that works perfectly well, and everyone's really, really happy with it, so now will you please bend the way that you do things so that I can write a script for myself so that I can then resolve dependencies with this own custom-rolled installing tool that I have. And it's not, I want to emphasize, I guess, that it's not, it isn't, I don't think for many people, I honestly do not believe that it's just, well, we've never had that before, so why do we need that now? It really is like a preference. Like, we would rather do this ourselves. We want to have that level of control over our systems. We don't want the added complexity. That's it. Like, don't ask for automatic dependency resolution. We're not going to do that. And that is the great thing about Linux. You can have Slackware that has not got automatic dependency resolution, and then you can have derivatives thereof, like Zenwalk and possibly Salix. I'm not sure because I haven't used Salix enough, but Zenwalk, I know, ships with, I think last time I checked, they ship with slapped get and, you know, things. Or maybe it's package tool, or not package tool. Something. It's something that does automatic dependency resolution. And, you know, I mean, hey, if people like that, then that's where they can go, is they can go to Zenwalk or Salix or whatever. And Slackware will continue not to have that, which everyone is fine with. So that's the debate to which I was referring. Thank you for your emails, Siggy. Really, really thought-provoking stuff, as I mentioned last time, I think. Okay, so that was Siggy. I got an email from Alan. Alan is a driver, a truck driver of, I think he said it was a truck driver. And he listens to a lot of podcasts and, you know, he consumes a lot of media, I guess. And so he emailed me and it was this kind of, he tricked me, and I don't know if he did it intentionally, but he was saying, so he bought this device that would do, I guess, four things that he kind of, you know, he was shopping for a device that would do four things. One is to watch videos. Two is listen to audio. Three is use as an ebook reader, and four is play an occasional quick game. So again, he's a truck driver. He's on the road a lot, so he wants media that he can listen to. And then when he's in the hotel or sleeping by the road or whatever he's doing, he can read an ebook or watch a video or play a quick game, you know, stuff like that, like little distractions. So he figured, okay, a tablet would be a good idea. And so he bought an iPad, an iOS 4 iPad. Not really sure what that means in terms of, you know, how old it is or whatever. I think they're on iOS 6 now. And so of course he got the thing, and it turns out that for, you know, he figured, well, okay, he'd spend the extra money to get, like, these programs to do editing, word processing and stuff like that. Turned out to be a major disappointment because you can't print, apparently, except to an Apple-approved printer. That's pretty funny, I thought. And it only saves in, like, specialized formats. And no matter what, you have to sync it to iTunes. And that doesn't work on Wine. So right there, you've got, like, a whole laundry list of these proprietary things that just because you went out and bought one device, you now have to – it ripples through your entire life potentially, you know, and makes you use all these other things. Worst case scenario, I guess, you don't have those – things, you know, you don't have iTunes, you don't have an OS that will run iTunes, so you've got to purchase an OS. I know, you don't really have to, but you should have to, right? I mean, like, if the world had its way, you would purchase the OS that would run iTunes, and then you would be syncing your device to this thing. So at some point, whether it was by accident or because he felt he needed to update something, he pulled in, like, iOS 6 or whatever the latest one is. And he says that at that moment, everything basically fell apart for him. I mean, the built-in obsolescence was so thorough that pretty much he could... I mean, the tablet can barely do anything that he wants it to do. I mean, it was already useless for one of the things, which was the word processing. That was already a moot point. But with the big operating system upgrade, it basically made everything just, it could barely run, pretty much. Now, I can argue that that's a problem with tablets in general, and I will argue that, actually. I mean, tablets and phones and these little gadget devices are not built for upgrades. I mean, you thought laptops were bad. I mean, tablets and phones takes it to a whole new level, right? There's no upgrade path for your hardware there. So that's a problem no matter what, I think. I mean, especially, I mean, here in the same episode, right? What, 20 minutes ago, I've been talking about running triple EPC with Enlightenment and the thing feels amazing. And, you know, poor Alan here upgrades from one iOS to the next, and the whole tablet becomes useless. Skips videos, you know, can't play music smoothly, just all kinds of stuff. I don't know. I mean, you know, you can email me tales of how great your tablet is and how that's not been your experience at all. And I'll believe, like, two of you, but everyone else is lying, because these tablets are built to die quickly. They're built to become old and crippled and for you to have to buy a new one. And it just, there's no way to win. And Alan basically says, yeah, they're consumption devices. They are not built to compute. They're built for you to consume media. And then in some cases, especially this particular brand that he bought, we'll give him the benefit of the doubt and say he bought it by accident. He didn't see what store he was in and what the brand on the tablet was. But in his case, it's obviously kind of even worse, because you update it fails, it doesn't work anymore. And it's very expensive. It's a more expensive than average tablet, so it probably hurts a little bit more for him. And there was one more email from, and oh, by the way, so Alan's email, I didn't read it. So I mean, I read it, but I mean, I didn't read it on the show, so you can't really get the feel for this. But when I first started reading it, I literally thought that it was that he was going to support. You know, that he was going to tell me that I was wrong about tablets. That's kind of how he wrote it. I don't know if he meant to do it that way. It was pretty funny, though. It was well done. So, very good writing there, Mr. Well, I won't say your last name, Alan. Nicely written. It fooled me. I thought you were going to tell me that tablets were the greatest thing and that I just didn't understand. But then, of course, you didn't. So, another email, this one from Jason, said that he started a new job a little while ago. Standard help desk type of thing, and they were going well. Corporate environment was embedded, Microsoft, all kinds of nonsense that, you know, I wouldn't touch with a 10-foot pole. But he says it was fine. And then they were just so happening to, they needed to post some how-to videos. And so they were asking, they asked him, like, how they could do such a thing on a limited budget. So he shows them a little video of his kid's soccer match, you know, and it's got titles and music. And they love it. They're like, this is great. How can we get something like this except for, you know, corporate how-to videos or whatever? And it turns out Jason did everything on Caden Live and Audacity and Linux, and voila, it was, and Jamendo, that was the other one, Jamendo. Oh, and Blender, he says. I didn't even notice that the first time. Point being that he really just, he says it really nicely. Don't hold up a placard, just speak up when there's a need, that Linux and free and open source software can uniquely fill. That's very succinctly and pragmatically put. I was going to say he was selling the results, not the tool set. And I think that's a big deal. That's a huge deal. And so many people, and myself and all of us, so often don't understand that, because what we want to sell deep down on many levels is the free aspect of this software. And as so many people have said on podcasts, the free thing, that's the part that no one cares about. No one understands it because they get everything for free anyway. Why would anyone want to use GIMP or Inkscape when they have the whole Adobe Creative Suite that they got from their friend who works in the IT department of some, multimedia school? You know, I mean, just no one needs the free aspect. No one understands the freedom aspect. They don't understand why it's important. Until they, I mean, some people do, right? And when do they realize it? I'll tell you when. They realize it when they can't open a file because they no longer have a license for something, or that software that they created that file in goes away. They went out of business. Things like that. Then they understand how significant it is for data to be written in universal or standardized formats. And even then they sometimes don't quite get it, right? I mean, I had people complaining to me left and right about the .docx format, and I kept telling them, look, .docx is horrible. It's not, you know, it's not a good format. Why don't we all use something else that everyone can understand? And that's just not, that doesn't make sense to them, because basically you're talking about like RTF and .txt. Because if you throw ODT at them, then their Microsoft Word can't open that OpenOffice document or that LibreOffice document. So it doesn't seem like a better thing. But then, so then you kind of have to explain to them, well, there's these developers and they'll always be around, and even if they're not, we've got the specs, so we'll know how to open these ODTs. And it just doesn't, it's over their head. But if you show people, like Jason did, this video, and they're like, yep, that's exactly what we ordered. How'd you do it? And it happens to be free and open source software. That's the way to sell it, because they don't care about anything except the end result. And that is just how it is. That's the way the world works. And it, if you think about it, that really makes more sense. It makes a lot less sense, I think, to really any sane person who wants to get anything done to care about where their stupid tool came from. I mean, it does make sense because longevity and sustainability and all that stuff. But I mean, come on, how many people think about that on a regular daily basis? Unless they just want to, like we do. We want to think of it that way. But everyday basis, people just trying to get their work done, they don't care about that stuff. One software application dies, another will appear on their desktop eventually. They won't know how it got there. They won't care, just as long as they can continue doing what they're supposed to be doing. So, Jason has a great point, which someone ought to do a whole episode on at some point, because it's just so well, such a good point. So thank you, Jason, for that email, and for selling Caden Live and Audacity and Fedora and Blender to your company. Okay, that's pretty long. I think this is going to be a long episode, but, you know, it's 21st. It's the Enlightenment release day. Come on, give me a break. Let's take a tea break. What's that? Yes, a tea break. I'll explain later. Yes, today I'm drinking tea, and I will explain why in a moment. But I'm drinking Adagio tea. This is an Earl Grey, sort of vanilla, creamy Earl Grey that someone sent me. And it's quite good, so if you have a snobby friend who sends you tea, then please join me in a cup of tea. Otherwise, go get a coffee. There's no great mystery to why I was drinking tea today rather than coffee. It's not going to be a long-lasting thing. It just so happens that someone sent me some tea for Christmas, some really nice tea from this place called Adagio.com on the internet. No affiliation to them, so you don't have to go rush off to Adagio.com and, like, buy tea from them now because I mentioned them. It's just, I'm just telling you that if you want good tea, I now know that such a place exists online. It's called Adagio.com. And I'm just enjoying a cup of tea today, so there you go. And actually, the person who sent that to me was The Last Known God, who you might know from as the forum administrator for Linux Reality Podcast, if you go that far back. So now I have been sent tea from someone who is connected in some small way to Linux Reality Podcast, which pretty much legitimizes me and my show. Since I have your attention, I might as well mention right now that on New Year's Eve at UTC-12, so that is, if you're in, like, America, it'll be the day that you think it's New Year's Eve, but then, depending on your time zone, like 10 or 11 hours further back. Starting at that point, all the way through New Year's Eve, until pretty much New Year's, you know, until it is the New Year, there will be a New Year's extravaganza Hacker Public Radio show for literally 24 hours, or I guess it's 24 hours. I don't know. Time zones are starting to confuse me. But it will be, yeah, a full rotation of the globe, I guess, is what it'll be. So, yeah, that's 24 hours. That is going to happen, and people are going to be calling into this Hacker Public Radio show. And they'll be talking and chatting, and I think Lawson Bronx will probably stop by and read a chapter of his latest release book. Pokey will be there. Other people will be there. I mean, I'm not going to start naming all the names of people who will be there. But anyway, everyone will be there. You should be too. If you get a chance, jump on Mumble. Dial up the Mumble server upon which Hacker Public Radio lives, and all the details will be over on hackerpublicradio.org, so just check that out to find out where to call in to. Or if you don't want to call in and you just want to listen, there's going to be a dozen and a half streams mirroring the show. So it's a live show. It's a long show. It'll be fun. I'm going to try to go the whole 24 hours, just like one of those 50s DJs, you know, where they used to stay up for like 2 weeks at a time and they'd start to see spiders and they'd go crazy. That's what I'm going to be doing, except for only 24 hours and probably without the spiders. So, yeah, it'll be really cool. So check that out on New Year's Eve into New Year's Day. Okay, almost finished. Just three more things. One, just a link to share with you that I posted online, something that I posted online. And then two little Christmas presents that I have for you for being such friendly and fun listeners to the show. Although, to be fair, actually, it's not exclusive, so even if you're not a listener to the show, you're going to potentially benefit from these gifts. But hey, at least you'll have heard about it first here, I guess. So the first thing is just a link of something that I threw online the other day, the other week, whatever, because I spent way too long figuring this stuff out. And the stuff to which I refer is a user interface thing, a theming issue. And so I have lately been getting some people, or some, I shouldn't say I've been getting people interested, because I'm not that type of person. So if people come to me and ask about Linux, then they have shown their interest. So lately I've been the target of people's curiosity, and they'll ask about Linux. There's a couple of people around me lately who have been interested, and I mean, I'm not going to tell them to go away and leave me alone. You know, I'm going to tell them what I know, and I do. And one of the things that I've noticed, as I've said before, is that GNOME 3 is a very appealing thing to these people, because they are users of a different operating system that looks and feels more similar to GNOME 3 than, for instance, stock KDE. Now, the other thing that I have noticed is that if you are going to get someone involved or interested in and using an operating system that you are kind of like the go-to person for in your little community, then you darn well better know what you're talking about and be prepared to solve problems and all that. And I mean, I knew that, and that's why I never used to be like the evangelical type for the old OS that I used to run. And in fact, I would discourage people fairly actively, because I knew right away, if they're like a Windows user and they're coming to this other operating system that I used to use, Deep Geek is drinking coffee right now, then I would be the guy, you know, it'd be my fault when something went wrong, or I'd have to fix it if it went wrong. So I would literally actively discourage people from doing that, because I didn't want to be that person. On Linux, I've been a little bit more friendly, because, I don't know, I'm a little bit more invested in Linux, you know. I mean, I'd be fine with people switching to that, because fixing stuff on Linux isn't really that, you know, it's kind of fun. It's got that angle of it being fun. I mean, not all the time. There are people who just make everything unpleasant, but those people I don't necessarily need to encourage, you know. So anyway, point being, if you're letting people in to the Linux world, then you need to know what you've recommended, you know. And it used to serious, and I've talked about this like many seasons ago, about like what distro would you recommend to someone else. And I really did used to think that there was a distribution that I could recommend other people to use. And it's kind of nice to think that there is. But in my experience so far, that has not been the case. And that if I recommend a distro that I do not actively use, then there's going to be something that they don't understand, and then they're going to call me and ask me, and then I'm not going to know the answer, because I don't use that distribution. I either can't think of the answer off the top of my head, because it's not something that I do every day, or even if it's something that I feel like I should know, it's something that is done differently on that distribution, or in some cases it's an error, it's a bug that I simply have never seen, because I've never seen that, you know, I don't use that distribution often enough to have triggered that particular bug. So in lots of different ways, it's a bad idea, at least from where I'm sitting, to recommend a distribution that one does not use actively, which narrows my choices down, realistically, to Slackware and Fedora. And so for the multimedia, for web people, I can very comfortably recommend Fedora. They get the GNOME 3, they get Fedora, they get everything that they need. I feel good about it. I feel pretty much like I can support everything that they need to have supported. And it's got the side benefit of just everything being very, I don't know, it's just so, you know, you install HTTPD, you install Drupal, and it puts it into like user share Drupal or something like that. It can be very integrated if you want it to be. So I don't know. There's a benefit there, but some people I've been recommending Slackware to, simply because they're doing a lot of multimedia, and that's I happen to run a site called Slacker Media. Why would I not recommend Slackware? One of the things about Slackware and Slacker Media in general is that it kind of recommends, it ships with KDE. That's what Slackware ships with, and KDE is something that I really, really enjoy using. I like it. I'm used to it. I think it's very powerful and very flexible, and you can pretty much configure it any way you want to. So to back that up, I thought that I felt that, and I think I've even said this before, KDE can be dumbed down enough, as it were, to be more GNOME-like, and that used to be more true than it is now, since GNOME 3 is completely different. It's just always felt like GNOME 2 was just kind of unnecessary, you know? It's just like, just make KDE more crippled, and you'll have GNOME 2. But I mean, that's politics of the past. I don't care about that anymore. So, anyway, I felt that me being able to support a Slackware user on KDE was important, but for them to be able to have an environment that is familiar or at least comfortable to them. And of course, in the environment that I'm in, really what that means is a more an environment a lot more like this other proprietary operating system, which is not Windows. DeepGeek takes another cup of coffee. So here we have KDE acting and feeling more like this other operating system. And you can find this link. I call it SMACK, SMACK. That would be Slackware, this other operating system, and KDE kind of all squashed together. So if you go to straightedgelinux.com/blog/how-to/smack, then you can see this detailed. This is nothing revolutionary. This is really like if you've been on Linux for any amount of time, and you've been on the internet for any amount of time, you've seen things like this. You know, it's like how to make Linux more like such and such, and that's what this is. But the difference, I think, is that most tutorials I've seen have been GNOME-centric, because it is typically the sort of the thought that GNOME is the one more like this other operating system, and KDE is not. But I think I show, albeit in about 20 steps. I mean, it's not a short process, and I could do things to make it easier on people, like, you know, come out with a script that would brute force all this stuff onto their system, but I didn't feel like that was very Linuxy of me. And if anyone actually does want to go this route, then going through the different KDE settings and the preferences and configurations will actually educate them about KDE more than if they just run a script that makes everything look the way they want it to. And that way they'll know in the future what they actually have choices over. You know, if they decide that something isn't exactly how they would prefer it to be, they could then go back to that system setting and change it. So in about 20 steps or so, 20 is probably putting it nicely, it's probably more like 30 once you get through all of the 20 steps, because there are obviously things that you have to do within each step. But it's good. It's a really reasonable way to theme the KDE desktop to be a completely different desktop. I mean, it really does change, obviously, the look of it, because you're putting different decorations and color schemes and stuff like that. But it really does, it doesn't emulate, you know, the environment that we're talking about, that I refuse to say the name of. But it does, it takes inspiration from it. So again, in terms of someone like a reluctant user who really wants to be back on their old platform, this wouldn't fool them. You know, it's I can speak very, very authoritatively on that, I think, because for a very long time I was that guy. I really didn't want to have to be changing the desktop quite so much. You know, there were conventions that I had just gotten really used to, really hard for me to give up. I mean, the global menu bar is a classic example, right? I swore up until like 4 episodes ago that I would never give up the global menu bar, that was the way computers were supposed to be made. And at this point, I can't say that anymore, because I actually find myself not really caring about it anymore, and even seeing some benefit to having separate menu bars on a per, at least a per application basis. Maybe not per window, that still seems a little bit redundant to me. But anyway, point is that this is a cool theming exercise. I posted pictures of the finished results, or actually semi-finished. I actually went in and tweaked it a little bit more. So, but there are some pictures on Unix Porn of the finished result, and I've been using it a little bit on my test machine, and I've got one friend using it. It's not bad. It it does a lot to make Linux a lot less foreign, let's put it that way. To certain users, this can make Linux seem that much closer to home rather than such a violent change. There are still a lot of things that are completely different, and it's certainly not going to fool anyone. But it is an interesting exercise in showing how configurable KDE is. So I'll leave you with that in terms of this topic. I mean, I call it SMAC. You can find it at straightedgelinux.com/blog/how-to/SMAC. And, I mean, if you want to go through all the steps, you certainly can. Otherwise, there's a lot of pretty pictures. You can just kind of scroll through and see some of the highlights of what I did. And, yeah, it's working. It's working pretty darn well, actually. And so the two reasons I wanted to mention it was, one, because this is a tutorial for KDE rather than for GNOME, which I think is unique. And then second, because when I was working on this thing, I was realizing how few effects there actually are on this other operating system. Like, when you're going to design it, you're turning off, like, all kinds of effects. You'll be amazed. I think the cliche is that this other OS is really glitzy and full of eye candy, and while that's kind of true, I don't think the eye candy is, like, effects, looking back at it. I think it's just kind of the design, the layout, the look. But if you really think of the effects that it has going for it, it's really not that many, like, you know, Compiz or Kwin-style effects. It's not like that many things really glow and bounce. Well, some things bounce a lot. And pulse and throb and shine and sparkle. It's a lot of just kind of like a couple of fade in and fade outs, a couple of zooms, a couple of slides. It's not that much. You'll be surprised, I think, if you actually go through this, which I don't really expect anyone of you to do unless you have to, but, you know, for a friend who wants a different environment. But I was surprised. I remember being surprised at how many effects I was turning off from the default configuration of KDE to get it to sort of a more, I guess, a minimal style desktop, really, like in a sense. But it was a fun exercise, and it really shows the power, I think, of the configurability of KDE. It also shows the cost, because yes, you can configure KDE to be this completely different looking and almost different feeling, really. Like, you have to use KDE differently, you know. You're not, at least I do, I don't use it the way that I'm used to. But it does show that you can configure it in a very drastically different way, but that it takes you a long time. I mean, there's a lot of configuration options. You really have to, I mean, when people say that KDE has a configuration option for everything, they're not kidding. I mean, it's like 20, at least 20 steps to get it into this different form. So, point of reference or something. Okay, so next let's talk about some things that I would like to announce a little bit. One, the one that you'll care about mostly, I think, is the multimedia, the great Linux multimedia sprint version 2 is actually done. I know, you're thinking, well, when did it start? Well, the last multimedia sprint, which was version 1, I kind of did as a community project, and I invited a bunch of people together to help me find all this material out on the internets, and we did, and it really worked out really nicely. And that is kind of what I intended to do for version 2. I was going to have another event, you know, and have people come and download stuff off the internet with me, and then package it together. But what ended up happening instead was that people kind of kept telling me about stuff, like via email, just like, hey, Klaatu, look, check this site out, you can grab all this stuff. And I was like, okay, I'll add that to my list. But instead of just adding it to my list, I would go to the site, download everything that they said I could download, and redistribute, and that would be done. So basically, like, a couple of weeks ago, I started looking at, like, this collection that I'd already amassed, and I realized that was it. It was over. I mean, like, when I was about ready to start, I realized I already had about a 2 gig, almost a 2 gig, or maybe it's 1 gig, I don't know, but, like, I think it's 1.8 gigs again, bizarrely. I already had a collection kind of formed and ready to release, so I just kind of went through what I had tossed out some of the stuff that just kind of seems silly or redundant, and I'm ready now to release the official second release of the Great Multimedia Sprint. So in case you're new to this concept, one of my things about multimedia on Linux is that we, being a free operating system, we kind of suffer in a way because we don't have a bunch of free materials, free raw materials at our disposal necessarily, because a lot of the creative stuff, unfortunately, because at least to my knowledge, you know, the sort of free culture, Creative Commons, is still a little bit young, at least in its formalized self. So, like, a lot of distributions, and just bandwidth concerns too, probably. I mean, a lot of distributions don't ship a whole bunch of, you know, they don't ship 800 fonts, they don't ship a bunch of textures and backgrounds and brushes with GIMP. You know, it's not something that you just get when you download the thing. Whereas with paid proprietary software, you very frequently do. You get a bunch of raw materials because that's partly what you're paying for, right? You're paying some studio musician to come in and lay down some loops for you, or some music beds for your editing application, or you're paying some photographer to go out there and take a bunch of close-ups of different textures, or a bunch of stock photos, or design a bunch of fonts. You know, the whole nine yards, that is rolled into the price, and that's what you're paying for. So on Linux, you don't have that, and even if we do, it's not in one centralized location. So these multimedia sprints are an effort to grab some of that stuff from all the different places that it exists online and put it into a centralized location. This one I had kind of intended to concentrate more on sound, and I think in a way I did that, and then in another way I kind of didn't. Anyway, what you get in this pack are 150 giga samples, so they're completely ready. They're samples in the gig format, completely ready for something like Linux Sampler and Q or J Sampler. So you can play along with all different kinds of musical instruments, or not along with, but with these instruments on your sampler application. They're free. I just took them from basically one website that had kind of collected them all and put them into a folder. So there's 150 of those for free. There's 99 hydrogen drum kits. This one I'm really proud of, because me and a friend of mine, Skirlet, who you may or may not know from older episodes and Fedora Reloaded podcast that I used to do, we sat down, she was visiting, so we sat down and we went through 99 different sample sets of different drum machines and different recordings of people who had sampled percussive sounds, all kinds of stuff, 99 of them. We went through, categorized everything according to the general MIDI spec so that it had some logic to it. And then I wrote a Python script and which would go into a folder, look at what was there, wrap everything into a hydrogen drum kit set, and spit out a hydrogen drum kit for you to load into hydrogen and use in hydrogen. So it's 99 hydrogen drum kits. Some of them are full, quote-unquote, full kits. Like, if the general MIDI spec says that this instrument is in it, then the instrument is in it. Not many of them are full. Actually, maybe none of them are full. Some of them are darn close. Some of them are just small little kits, like with 10 different sounds in it. But we tried to do it sort of logically and artistically. Some of them are from real drum machines that actually are known to exist. Some are kind of like weird internet things that we found that we weren't really too sure about, but we're, you know, we kind of invented drum machines for them to be a part of. Whatever. They take sounds from like freesound.org. They take sounds from different places online, from, you know, it's all over the place. Some of them I sampled myself. It really just depends on what we had to work with, but there's 99 of those. So that's a lot of work went into that, and hopefully you can do something creative with that. Threw in about 50 different GIMP enhancements. So there's a bunch of GIMP pressionist filters, which helps you like with texturizing stuff. There's an animation tools package, which I don't really use, but I kind of played around with. There's some, I think, I forget, something else in the enhancements. Oh, Photoshop Menu RC. That's actually quite handy. Some of the Photoshop keyboard shortcuts are just, they just make more sense. There's gradients, there's color palettes. There's about 150 different little patterns that you could theoretically use on like websites and things like that for backgrounds or just for your art as a background to kind of tile, you know, with Inkscape or whatever. There's 11 different fonts. I mean, you've already got 2,455 from the previous one, but here's 11 more. And then there's about 29 GIMP brushes, or I should say GIMP brush sets, because actually within each set there's a lot more, so you're getting a lot more than that. There are 6 different icon sets, just because. There are about 9 different wallpapers, just because. And I think that's about it. But yeah, the total package size of the of that multimedia sprint as a TAR BZIP is 820 megabytes, and then when it is uncompressed, you will be looking at 1.1 gigabyte of free stuff. So it should be really, really nice. I think you'll get a lot of use out of this. I've already gotten a lot of use out of a lot of these components. I think you will too. So please do check that out, and I'll post a link to it. And please do torrent this. You know, create torrents, post it places, get it out there, because I think Linux users, again, the worst thing for an artist, at least for me as an artist, is to sit down at a computer and you're ready to create something, and then you realize, oh, I don't have anything to use. I've got nothing but like circle and square brushes, nothing with texture, or I was going to write some music, but I realized I don't have really, really any synth sound, or I've got like those 3 default ones from Ysynth, and that's all I have. You know, and at some point you start to get, you need more than that, you know? So having a big kit of creative materials really, really helps. So download this, use it, put it to good use, make cool stuff with it. I know that I intend to. The other thing that I have for you is an audiobook by a friend of mine wrote it, and then a friend of mine read it, a different friend of mine, Skirlet, actually read it, and a friend of mine wrote the story. It's called Revolution Radio. It actually has like little tiny cameo appearances, I think, from like Jude Cross, who is Peter 64's wife, K5 Tux, who is K5 Tux from Linux in the Ham Shack, Lost in Bronx, I think he's in it, I'm sure he is, you know, little cameos here and there. It's a story, bizarrely, about a time after the post-apocalypse when system administrators and ham radio operators have taken over the world, which sounds really funny, but it's not actually played for comedy at all. It's just kind of this weird, serious, post-apocalyptic science fiction story that really kind of wanders around and doesn't really have a point and has a plot that only I will ever understand. But if you want to listen to it, it's an audiobook now. I will link to it. There's also an ebook if you would prefer to read it with your eyes. And you're certainly welcome to experience that. So those are 2 things that I have for you this Christmas. I hope you enjoy them, and I'll see you for the Hacker Public Radio New Year show. That's it for this week's episode. Thank you very much for listening. My name is Klaatu. You can reach me via email at klaatu@member.fsf.org. You can find me online at gnuworldorder.info or slackermedia.info. You can contact me via Jabber at notklaatu@jabber.org. You can also catch me in IRC as notklaatu. I'm on the Freenode network in the channels Ogcast Planet, Dev Random, Slacker Media, Slackware. Any of those will do. Thank you very much for listening, and I'll talk to you next time.
coffee will be ready soon. We'll have a cup and try again.